Well, hello again, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
And today we are just going to air a rerun for you because we know it's the holidays and things are getting kind of busy. So we are going to play our episode about a very festive episode, How the Ghosts Stole Christmas. Mm. But we do have some tweets to read for you guys about our The Field Where I Died episode. So why don't we get into those?
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay, tweet of the week. As Annie said, these are tweets in response to our episode all about The Field Where I Died, which is always an episode that garners interesting reactions. From Kathy G. Kathy says, I'm still listening, so I'm sure I'll have more to say later. But I think the writer's intent was to put the brakes on MSR to show that Scully is important to Mulder, but not romantically. He may never have romance in this life because he and Melissa only met in passing, but the viewers shouldn't expect any romantic relationship with Scully. We now know that's not how it played out, but I think The Field Where I Died was an attempt to stall things. The part cut from the script about Mulder subconsciously processing the names would have made all the difference for me. I just needed to touch more ambiguity. Yeah, I certainly agree with Kathy's last point about the script segment that was not in the episode, but that you very kindly shared with us during the episode, Annie, that would have made a big difference in terms of creating that ambiguity that Kathy mentions. I think it's an interesting idea that she suggests that this was, and it did kind of feel like that at the time, I have to say, that this was Chris Carter and the powers that be trying to sort of put the brakes on the MSR and saying, not going to happen, which of course turned out not to be true. But I can see why you would have seen it that way at the time. I did kind of feel like that was the message they were sending at the time, although looking back on it, obviously that wasn't how it worked out. But I think it's a fair point.
Yeah, I think it's a fair point too. I mean, much to what I was saying when we were talking about this, like I wasn't watching live at this time, so I can't possibly put myself in the shoes of you and the viewers at that moment. But I will stand by what I believe is that I don't think that Chris Carter intended to not have them get together at some point. I mean, I always think that that was going to happen probably at the end of the show. I think in his mind, he would have held it off until the very, 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 very end. So I don't necessarily think that this was a signal to viewers that it's never going to happen. Right. I don't agree with that at all, but I do agree with the stalling idea. Like, mm-hmm. I think mm-hmm. that maybe it's kind of like a little signal to people like to, hey, slow down, folks. Like it's definitely not happening anytime soon. And I think I don't think that the events in the episode show that, but I definitely can buy that the attitude of the writers by putting this episode out to begin with could have sent that signal, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That was certainly the way it was received in a lot of quarters. That's for sure. So yeah, I think that's a great point. And Yulia makes a similar point amongst her other excellent comments. Yulia says, thanks, ladies. I really enjoyed this episode and Annie's fanfic, A Sage's Path. Yes, just side note, that's a great fanfic. I enjoyed it very much.
Oh,
very interesting. Really interesting insights into the episode, as Annie always brings to her fanfic. So little plug, but really totally legit. Yulia says, A Sage's Path helped me to change my attitude towards The Field Where I Died a lot. Although I still have mixed feelings about the episode, I absolutely adore how Rob Bowman and Mark Snow work here. Can't say the same about how the writers work. For me, the main idea that Mulder and Scully is that Mulder and Scully are two souls that are bound with love. Friends, parents, or romantic partners doesn't matter, and they can carry it through different lifetimes. They always come back together. Back in the day, everyone speculated on the idea of Scully's death because the episode implies she dies before Mulder in different lives. It was really frustrating. Also, it seemed they were trying to keep Mulder and Scully from any romantic relationship with the always-to-be-friends idea to continue the tension between Mulder and Scully, especially after all those pusher things. Right now, I can see that was not what they were trying to say. So, yeah, great points from Yulia there, too. It's coming back to me now, this idea that everyone suddenly started to believe that Scully was going to die because she had died in these past lives. And I had forgotten that, but I think Yulia's right that was the subject of wild speculation at that time. So I think that's a really great point to bring up. And she also agrees, obviously, with a little bit with Kathy, that it was sort of trying to slow down the kind of MSR a little bit.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too, actually, when I was writing that story. I was doing a lot of like research on like, okay, what times were they living in? What ages were they when they died? And I came to realize that there really was no rhyme or reason to it in terms of how old they were when they died. And like there were, he was like Samantha, who was Samantha in one life? It was like, or it was like Scully, Scully was his father. Right. So yeah. Like clearly
and Samantha was his son or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah. And so clearly the timing of their deaths really has no relevance to the current life is what I'm saying.
Right.
So
right.
I can see how people might think that because in each of those lives, like he's like Scully, yeah. Scully. But I mean, to me, all that told me was that he went to Scully first. Like he immediately went to her. And Melissa was almost an afterthought. And I feel like people were just. I mean, he was crying because he was already upset. But like it, I think that a lot of people overlooked that Mulder we know in 1997 or whenever this was, when he is being regressed, he immediately goes to Scully. She's the first one he goes to, and I think that's pertinent. I think
that's,
it's meaningful.
Yeah, a very key point that I had never noticed, mainly because I refused to ever watch the episode again. But now that I have, excellent point. From Karen Rainknight. Karen says, she starts off saying, I'm only like 5 minutes into the discussion and I'm already experiencing PTSD, but not for the reason you might expect. I first saw this episode a couple of months before I got internet access at home and really loved it. I had no idea what the fan reaction was at the time. Then I got internet access and joined some X-Files communities and made the mistake of saying I liked the episode and was absolutely attacked for it. It made me feel bad about liking the episode, and I felt weird about it ever since. It was part of the reason that even though I was a shipper, I was hesitant to identify as one online in those early years. I didn't see the episode as anti-MSR when I saw it, the opposite really, but ever since then, I've doubted myself, and now I have trouble enjoying it. And then after Karen finishes the episode, she says, okay, I feel so much better after finishing the podcast. A lot of what Eddie said reflected my initial impressions of the episode when I watched it. It was much more focused on the shippy interactions and didn't get hung up on the Melissa as soulmate thing. And you guys probably already know how I love the more platonic side of the MSR just as much as the romantic side. So thank you for discussing that and how wonderful and unique their relationship is, because it does encompass so many things. Great points from Karen there, as usual. And that's a really interesting point about being a shipper back in the day. I mean, I was a shipper back in the day in the online community, but I was kind of with the majority of being like, no, we hate this episode. So, yeah, I can see that especially if you had watched it kind of in isolation from that sort of fan reaction, and then to find out that all the shippers hated it when you didn't, it would be awkward. And you know what it's like online. It's hard to disagree sometimes.
You know, it's funny. When I was reading Karen's tweets, I was like, oh, I had a very, very similar reaction with My Struggle 4, Runs and Hides. I remember watching that episode thinking that it was going to be so much worse than it was. And I walked out of it going, wow, we made it out of that alive. It wasn't too bad. All right. Okay.
A bit worse.
Okay, cool. And I was like, fine with it. I was like, okay, it wasn't great, but whatever. And then I went online and I was like, well, holy shit. And I agree with Karen in that can really affect your feeling, and it can give you PTSD when you want to like rewatch it or revisit it, because you really associate it with those horrible feelings that you had when you were, you know. And so I get it.
It takes the fun out of it in a lot of ways.
It really does. It's upsetting and it's unfortunate. But I really like what Karen had to say about honoring all the different parts of MSR, because I think a lot of people, shippers, et cetera, or I say, not et cetera, I should say shippers especially, are so focused on the lack of romance that we get on the show that they sort of sometimes fail to see all the other great things that this relationship has and all the different parts. And I, again, have to shout out to all the different kinds of love that there are out there.
Absolutely.
And it's just holding romantic love as a higher form of love over all the other things is just, that's not a thing that I enjoy. So much as I love their romantic love, and I'm obviously glad that it eventually got there, I don't think that it diminishes it that it took so long to get there. And I don't think that it diminishes it to express in this episode that there are so many different things to each other at all. And in fact, I only think it enhances it. So
Yeah, absolutely. I remember having a conversation with someone that identified themselves as a no Romo. And she said she hated the phrase, and I can totally get it now. I didn't totally see it that way at the time, but I totally get it now. She hates the phrase more than friends.
Yeah.
As though, like, friends is on one level.
Right.
But then to have a romantic relationship is being more than friends. And, you know, I totally get it now. I've kind of grown a little bit, I hope, in that, like, respect. And I understand that, yes, this idea of, you know, society in general sort of seeing romantic love as being somehow superior to other kinds of love, like, you know, familiar or friendship, it's not accurate and it's not helpful.
No. And I mean, I would hope that, or think that, the more than friends thing, because we all say that, I would hope that that is just merely sort of a semantics issue, because I don't think people mean that in terms of value. I think they just mean, like,
I think they do.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Not always. I mean, you know, sir, I do sometimes use that phrase, not meaning it. I just mean, in addition to friends, they are also romantic partners. But sometimes I think some people do mean, like, it's something better than.
Yeah. It's not, I mean, it's, and I mean, everybody says that. So this isn't like a shout out on people who say that phrase, because it's just.
Oh, I say it. Yeah.
Yeah. We all say it because, and we all have kind of made this very specific meaning for it, that this is what the difference is between being just friends, and even the words just friends, like, that's kind of, it's, that's slightly problematic too, because then
it kind of is.
It's inherent in that phrase is that friends isn't good enough. Like,
our friendship
is somehow less valuable because we're not fucking, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think
like that's somehow, right? Is less than.
It's so weird to me. And so
I'm starting to kind of come around on that and trying to see that from sort of another lens, and trying to kind of bear in mind, especially for folks that identify as asexual or aromantic. I think for people like that, that kind of thing really stands out to them, because they're just kind of, that's always a little bit on their radar, because it kind of, you know, gets under their skin a little bit, understandably. And so I'm trying to be a little more aware of that. And as much as I love the romance, I'm working on appreciating the friendship aspect of Mulder and Scully as well, because that is extraordinary in and of itself. It's why the romance is great for me. Romance without, like, this amazing underlying friendship that they have would have been pretty boring to me. And it's the friendship that makes the romance interesting to me.
Yeah, and I think that this is why I have always identified MSR as Mulder-Scully relationship and not Mulder-Scully romance. I know a lot of people define it Mulder-Scully romance, but I don't. Like, my definition for that is Mulder-Scully relationship, because I often think that a lot of the sweetest quote-unquote MSR moments are moments that could be interpreted as friendship, and there's nothing wrong with that. Like, there's really nothing wrong with that. And this is by no means are either of us saying we are no Romos. That's not what we're saying. Because I feel like, and I wasn't present for these conversations between no Romos and shippers, because by the time I was in the fandom, like,
it was over.
Like, it was shippers had won. So it was just one of those things that, like, when I hear about people who are saying no Romos, I feel like they are still either in huge denial, or they are just sort of trying to get across the point that we're saying, is it's like, it's not that I don't think that they should be romantic. It's just that I don't necessarily agree with the viewpoint that so much energy should be focused on that when we already have been given so much, much love of all different kinds between these two characters from the beginning, and watching it evolve and grow and change over 7 years until they finally decide, all right, we're giving up on this, is so exciting and interesting to me to see all those different levels of it and all those different iterations of it. And, you know, I'll get off my soapbox now, but I do find the Feel Where I Died always brings these conversations up for me, which I enjoy, so.
Yeah, no, this episode for sure definitely sort of celebrates those other types of love. And I think that, we're missing something if we don't appreciate that. So I think that that's great. Rachel also kind of fits in with this conversation as well. Rachel is Blue says, I enjoyed this discussion. I identified as a no Romo in the 90s, but more in the sense that I believed Mulder and Scully had this incredible bond that was so deep, I didn't need to see physical romance on the screen. What can I say? I was young. So I always liked this episode in the sense that it reinforced that belief. Who needs to see kissing when you have evidence that their souls come together every lifetime? Just kidding. Now that I'm older and wiser, I definitely need to see kissing. Okay, fair enough. I'm not going to disagree with that.
No.
Other points. I love Mulder as an ugly crier because I think it tracks with his personality. He's emotional and puts it all out there, whereas Scully's tears are always lovely and controlled, just like her. Last, I have a bit of a fascination with Jonestown and highly recommend A Thousand Lives by Julia Shears for anyone who's interested in learning more about it. You'll never think about drinking the Kool-Aid the same way again. Thanks, Rachel, for all that great information. I really love her point about Mulder as an ugly crier, because, you know, I have kind of issues with Mulder's ugly crying. But this is a great way to kind of, you know, put it in a character context. Mm-hmm. And it makes a lot of sense. Yeah, he just puts it all out there. Yeah. He doesn't care about how ugly he's crying.
Nope.
And that's a great point, because, yeah, Scully's tears usually are very lovely and controlled, too. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what I go for, I guess. But that's a great point from Rachel that just reflects their character. There's no good or bad crying here. There's just different. So
exactly. Just like there's no good or bad kind of love. There's just different.
Yeah.
See how this all came back circle.
So like open and loving and just so appreciating everything and everyone tonight. And I love it.
That's the best possible way. Also, thanks for that recommendation, Rachel. It's going right into my Kindle.
Yeah. I'm going to have to check that out, too, because, the Jonestown story, because we talked about that in the context of The Field Where I Died, because it does kind of touch on some Jonestown elements. It's a fascinating story for anyone that doesn't know a lot about it. And I have not read that book, so I think I'm going to have to pop that onto my Kindle as well. So thanks for that, Rachel. From Fleetwood Snack, I have so many feelings about this one. First of all, I love this ep. Of the show and the podcast. Thank you. Annie was speaking to my soul, because I think this episode does way more to show that Mulder and Scully are soulmates than not. They've filled so many roles to each other in the past. And in this life, they're a little bit of all of them again, friend, protector, parent, but also so much more. Their souls were learning over all these lifetimes how to be together in this extremely deep and intimate way to be everything to one another. Also, Mulder literally never thinks about Melissa again, so he clearly isn't mourning a lost opportunity for love. Mulder and Scully are meant to be together in this life, but in my opinion, what's most important is that they choose to be together, no matter what. All great points, mm-hmm. I think, from Fleetwood Snack there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I couldn't have said it better myself, so.
Yeah, absolutely. Very well said. I love that. And on that subject of sort of choosing to be together, Hard Eyes for David said, thank you for this. I love this episode. I have always thought that because Melissa is dead with no romantic connection in this life, Mulder is free to choose who he loves. Isn't it more romantic that they made a choice to be romantic than that they were destined to be together? And Isadub chimed in there and said, I agree, living is making choices. And Mulder and Scully have always been challenged in their choices in many aspects of their lives. That's I love that idea, actually. That's a really great point, mm-hmm. that this idea that, in some ways, if we had found out in The Field Where I Died that Mulder and Scully were fated to be souls together, it would kind of take something away in a sense. Right. It is kind of more romantic that they choose each other rather than just, you know, they were going to just wind up together no matter what they did.
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of what I was like angling at when I was saying like the different, like, okay, we have what Mulder believes, what the writers believe, and what the truth is. And I'm just always kind of like, well, the truth is that Mulder ended up with Scully. So at the end of the day, none of what happened in this episode mattered. So I'm not saying that in terms of like, oh, this episode sucks, it didn't matter. I'm just saying that like they made that choice to be together. Yeah. I love too how that ties in at the very, very, very end in one of your favorite scenes, Nothing Lasts Forever, when Mulder finally does say, I'm right here, that's my choice. And I mean, that's so powerful. You know what I mean?
It's like, so powerful.
Hearing him say that is still such a gift. And every time I think about it, I get all like butterfliesy. So
really is great tie in there with one of my fave episodes. Mm. And from Daniela Modio. Hi, Daniela. Daniela says, hi there. A question for Annie. During the ep, you mentioned that in the revival, there might be evidence of the fact that Mulder and Scully have got married. Interesting point. Which moment would that be? Very curious. I might have a theory myself. I'd like to hear that theory, actually, Danielle. But Annie, what's your theory?
Oh, when I said that, I was referring to the bit in My Struggle 1 when they have their little tense moment in the limo and Mulder says, yeah, she says, Scully says, we've been moved on. We've moved on with our lives. And he says, yeah, for better or for worse. Or she says, for better or for worse. And then he says, for better or for worse. It's just very pointed marriage language. And I just like, it's very, I don't even want to say it's subtle because it's really not very subtle at all. But like, it's definitely handled in a very X-Filesy way that like, they're not going to just come out and say it because that's not what they do on this show. Yeah. But it is a really sort of nice hint slash indication that perhaps there was a marriage at some point or currently even. In their past or present. And that was the moment that I was referring to.
Yeah, I think that's a great point because it is very pointed the way that Mulder especially says for better or for worse. So I think that, yeah, we can definitely make that leap without too far a reach. But I'd like to hear Daniela's theory as well. From Jessica Skelly. Hi, Jessica. Jessica says, I don't think anyone can claim romantic love is a higher form of love. Quoting Annie, I think, there. Awesome, Annie. In the West, we love being in love, sometimes at the expense of the object of our love. And then Jessica quotes someone named de Rougemont, who I don't know, but we're all learning, to look upon passion as a transfiguring force. And then she says, for ourselves is to use our beloved. Very deep, Jessica. We love it. All that rational philosophical stuff said, I reacted just like Jen in 1996. great discussion. Thanks, Jessica. Yeah, I like that. I like that. Like, we can all be very sort of philosophical about it now, but like at the time, we were like, no, pulling our hair out. So,
yeah,
I like that. I'm going to look up de Rougemont too. I'm loving it.
I thought that was a really nice quote. And
I think it's beautiful.
Very important and sort of, I mean, not wanting to sort of denigrate passionate love because it is wonderful and everybody loves it, especially on their screens. But it is nice, again, to see all the different types of love and how they are not greater than the other.
Yeah. I think that's some really interesting points there. So thanks for that perspective, Jessica. And from Erica Deb. Waste the grums. Finally listened. I feel like the thing that bugs people is the possibility that Mulder had ever had a romantic relationship in any life with anyone other than Scully. People want them to be together in all lives. That being said, when I saw this episode, this immediately became my belief in what happens when we die or what I hope happens. I love that Scully has been many roles for him. Nurturer, leader, lover. And if these lives are to teach us, maybe they led them to the roles where they belong. I think that's really beautifully put, Erica, and kind of very much in keeping with what we were talking about. Hey, Annie?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I think. It's the whole idea of to learn. I mean, they make a big deal about saying that we come back different every time to learn. And I love that. And I mean, she makes a good point, and I think that you can probably attest to this. At the time, people probably were upset that, oh, well, how dare they even imply that Mulder was with someone else romantically in a different life? Like, it's not enough that we don't have jack shit in this life. Yeah. We need them to be together in every life. Yeah, I can see how everyone would
Yeah, when you think about it that way, it does sound like we expected an awful lot. It's like, not only do you have to be completely monogamous now, you have to have been totally with Scully for every life you've ever had. It's like, wow, we were pretty demanding, weren't we?
Yeah, you were. But, you know, it also, it is interesting to me that it's in her tweet, she said that, you know, people were upset. Obviously, people want them to be together in all lives. And that's exactly what the episode told us.
Yeah, that together just in a different way.
Right. But, you know, not the same way in all lives. And they are clearly will be romantic in this life. So it's just, I don't know, they were together in all lives. And I don't think the episode ever said any different. So,
yeah, no, great points. Thanks, everyone, for your tweets. They were just like, what wonderful sort of like mini essays we got this week. They were great. So thanks for the mini essays, for the two-word tweets, for the series of emojis, whatever you want to send our way. Please feel free to tweet at us at any time at XFD Podcast, and we look forward to chatting with you there.
Mulder, the internet is not good for you.
So, How the Ghost Stole Christmas. This is season 6, episode 6. Written and directed by the one and only Chris Carter.
I know him.
Yeah.
Well, not personally, but I know.
What I wanted to say before we went into the tweets was that I felt like this, because I was talking about my husband's reaction to this episode, and it felt to me kind of like a Bad Blood type episode in that you can probably appreciate it more if you're a fan and you kind of understand the dynamic, the Mulder-Scully dynamic. Okay. Do you kind of agree with that? Because, I mean, he gets it. He gets it, but I think it doesn't quite sink in the way it would sink in with us because we know what is to come and what has come before and all of the little minuscule details about their relationship. And
That's a very interesting point. I mean, I think the episode plays on a couple of different levels. On sort of a very surface level, it can just be like this cool haunted house episode. In fact, I love talking about my tattoo, so I'll just throw in a brief tattoo story. When I was getting my tattoo of my dog's paw approximately 1 month ago, see the picture of it on my Twitter. My tattoo artist was a big X-Files fan, not like quite on our level of X-Files fandom. He didn't like interact with the fandom, but he loved watching the show. But you know, it had been a long time since he had watched many episodes. And one of the few episodes he could remember off the top of his head was this haunted house episode. But he described it as it was that Halloween episode with Ed Asner in it. So he remembered it as a Halloween episode, but he remembered Ed Asner. So I think that Ed Asner and Lily Tomlin kind of make it a little bit more sort of give it a broader appeal to folks that aren't like the hardcore fans.
Yeah.
So yeah, there is a lot about characterization in this. There's a lot of psychoanalysis, which I find really super interesting and fascinating about Mulder and Scully as individuals, as well as their relationship. And if you're not like a hardcore fan, that may not really grab you. But I think there's probably enough sort of spooky, scary, funny stuff going on that would probably keep you going anyway. Although some people and their husbands might walk away and say, that was just weird.
No, I mean, it's not that he didn't like it. I think he was just kind of like, wasn't really quite sure what to make of it. Like,
what the hell was that?
Yeah, because it is, and I mean, we'll get to this when we get to the actual mechanics of what's going on. By the end of it, it was just like, what? Like, he really thought that he shot Scully, and then he was like,
yeah.
And which, I mean, I feel like the first time I watched this, first few times I watched this, it took me a while to sort of figure out exactly what was going on. And who knows? I still don't know entirely sure. I'm not quite entirely sure.
It is kind of a complicated plot and a complicated ending. When we were putting together our sort of ideas of what we wanted to talk about tonight, I added, what exactly is going on there about the whole scene with the shootings and what follows? Because, yeah, I mean, I've watched this episode many times. It's one of my favorites. But I still kind of get a little confused about exactly who knows what and who's doing what at each moment. So
we can break it down.
Yeah, we'll break it down. If you're not paying close attention, then you would definitely be confused, I think, as a viewer. So it is a little confusing, but I think that, yeah, once you kind of catch on, you can get the general gist of it for sure. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting. It's an interesting way that it played out. Is it possible that Chris Carter could have clarified it? I don't know. He could have, I suppose. But then you run into a possibility of it just being kind of dumbed down and a bit too obvious. So
right.
Like the X-Files always is, it's a little subtle.
I think that's par for the course for this show. It's so funny. Whenever I think about Chris Carter and the X-Files, I always think of, you've seen Mary Poppins, right? The movie.
I have not seen Mary Poppins.
Are you serious? I am outing you. I thought that was going to be an easy yes. Okay, well, there's a point.
I mean, I know it very well just from because I'm alive in Western society.
Okay, well, there's a part in the movie where she says, there's something you need to know about me. I don't explain anything. And every time I see that movie and I hear that line, it makes me think of Chris Carter because it's very much, very much the case. Like, it's like the tagline in Ghoulie when it's like, you see what I want you to see. And it's true. It's his show. Yeah. You know what I mean? He gets to explain just as much as he wants to.
Yeah, as much or as little. He demands a lot of the audience. Really does. To really get everything, he demands a lot. And that's why we're at like, you know, year 26 and still talking about the show, because there's a lot to it and a lot of levels to it. And that's why I love the show.
Same. Totally agreed. I mean, it would not be as fun to discuss if there weren't these things to to try and figure out for years and years and years. So,
yeah, I'm figuring stuff out.
Yeah, exactly. Awesome. Do you want to get into the plot of the actual Mulder Scully story, or did you want to talk about Lily Tomlin and Ed Asner first?
Let's talk. Maybe we'll talk about Lily and Ed first.
Okay.
Because once we get into the plot, that'll take us in all kinds of really cool directions.
Right.
Lily Tomlin and Ed Asner, they were, you know, very big names. Even today, you
yeah.
know, would be considered big names. And certainly back then, very big names. And not just big names, but played the parts so well. I love them. I love them in anything they've done outside of the X-Files as well. I just think they're both great actors. I think they definitely go a long way to making this episode, because the whole episode is just Mulder and Scully and Maurice and Lyda. So you need to have strong actors to kind of hold up that side of the story.
Yeah.
And I think they're both amazing.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, too, that the idea that it's only the four of them this entire episode helps with a little bit with keeping it as simple as possible, because you have a lot of complex stuff going on, obviously, in this episode.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I feel like adding anything else, like even more scenes that don't take place in the house, the ones that start and end the episode are just scenes with Mulder and Scully talking. It's all just talking. Like, it's not necessarily like a ton of action. There's not a lot of exposition or anything. It's just it's just characters talking in rooms. And I mean, I feel like a lot of the time they don't really have a chance to do that on this show very often.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, they don't. I really appreciate that particularly. Yeah. And they like you said, they grabbed really two great actors that they knew could carry it when they had to.
Yep.
Lily Tomlin and Ed playing Lyda and Maurice. And they're great. It's awesome.
Can I just pick up on the point you just made about sort of how it's a relatively contained episode, which is part of what I love about it, I think. I mean, I love plays and I love talky kind of stuff, so this is just right up my alley. And I think the episode, aside from the very final scene, I think it kind of unfolds in real time, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
It feels like it does, at least.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering... you know this terminology better than I do. Would this sort of qualify as what is in the TV world called a bottle episode, which is probably defined as like an episode contained to kind of one set and one storyline? It's sort of a play-like kind of contained episode. Would you say that this falls into that category?
I mean, I actually don't know that term because I don't work in live action, but it sounds right to me.
Look at that. I came up with something.
Yeah,
I feel smart.
It does feel like it could be like a play. Like it, and,
yeah, yeah.
And it, like you said, it all runs in real time. I mean, it does feel like, okay, it's almost like, okay, Scully's going to go off so Julian can take a break for 10 minutes while Mulder does his bit, and then Mulder gets to go off and David gets to take a break for 10 minutes while Scully comes. It's like they could perform this episode live. Yeah, they really could.
I could just kind of picture like they'd have like a cool like rotating stage or something
where
they go from room to room. And I think that would be super cool. We should definitely mount a stage production of this, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You and I, we could be the producers. And I think we could also star in it.
Look at this. We could also get Larry, since he's really great at...
Shit, yes. Larry's going to play all four roles.
He could do all the roles. Look, we got it. It's done.
Yeah, done. All right.
But
because I think it is one of the things I really like about the episode is I love, you know, I love character-driven stories. I love dialogue. I love acting. And that's what this episode really relies on. Although, you know, there's not much in the way of sets, but the sets they have are super cool.
Yeah.
And really well used and utilized. I mean, the cool sort of walking from one room to another, it's an identical room, or is it? That's really well photographed and spooky and cool. And even though it more or less happens all in the same room, it doesn't feel like it's all in the same room, and they do really cool things with what they are given.
Right.
So I think it's really well done. This probably saved them a lot of money on the budget compared to an average episode, I suspect, which I think is the general idea of a bottle episode. It's like if you've run out of money or need to save money on the budget, you have a bottle episode because you don't have to spend a lot of money since it's all in one place.
Do you know if this is a set? Or if it's like an actual house?
I don't know. I was curious, actually. It looks like a house to me, but I don't know. I wonder if pretty amazing sets out there, so it could well be a set.
Yeah, I wonder if part of it was set and part of it was maybe shot inside a real house or, you know.
Yeah.
It's possible.
I think it could be. I mean, it could be like, you know, who knows, maybe there's like a couple of standard haunted housey type sets that folks in Hollywood use, and this was one of them. I don't know, but it looks great.
Yeah.
It looks beautiful. I mean, the chandelier with the cobwebs on it and everything, it's beautifully shot. It's a very cool setting. So I really like what they did with it. Very creatively done. I mean, it could have been a bit of a boring episode, quite frankly, especially kind of the way we're describing it with, you know, not a lot of variation in sets and not a lot of action, but it's done so well in terms of the writing and the acting and the directing.
And it's paced very well.
It is paced really well.
Yeah.
It's got, it's entertaining from start to finish. I think it's just a very, very well done episode. I think it's in my top 25. I think it's like number 15 on my top 25 of all time X-Files episodes because of all those things.
Yeah, it was in mine too. I think mine was a little closer to the bottom of the list, but I mean, still it's a great one. You notice we were talking about how it feels like just a lot of people in rooms talking. And I think that it's funny to me because just a couple weeks ago or a few weeks ago, we were talking about I Want to Believe and how rare it is for us to see them talk with any sort of depth or, you know, length about their relationship.
Yeah.
Even though their relationship is at a very different place in this episode, that's what makes it great and interesting because we still don't really know what's going on. And it's funny because they kind of poke fun at that throughout the episode because like Maurice and Lyta don't really know what's going on. Mm-hmm. Particularly Lyta doesn't really know what's going on either. And she kind of is us. She's kind of us in this episode because it's like, but like, you're both so attractive. Like,
what's up with that?
Yeah. And it's just, it was very funny. And every time I think of sort of the fun that gets poked at Mulder and Scully and their platonicness, it just makes me laugh that Chris Carter wrote this because it's like, he knows what people are thinking. And, you know, it just to poke fun at it, I think is really great. And to do that through those characters was such a brilliant idea.
Yeah. I always love the idea of seeing Mulder and Scully sort of from a different perspective, from the perspective of another character. I think I tweeted once something like, I love to play the game. What do other people in this scene think Mulder and Scully's relationship is?
Yeah.
And this episode is all about that, so I really love that aspect of it too.
Yeah. Well, let's get into this then, the actual, what's going on here? This episode,
what's going on here?
Yeah, this episode plays very heavily into themes of, you know, suggestibility and fear. And I think that like that's kind of the idea behind what Maurice and Lyta are trying to get these people to, I guess, succumb to every year. And it's interesting to me. What do you take in terms of how they know what they know? Like, I know this all kind of comes down to how exactly is this episode working? Like, do they just know because they're ghosts and they know?
Do they have like special mystical powers?
Right. Or is it really just like they say that it's all in their head and they're projecting this upon themselves? Which, I mean, I think is almost more interesting, even though that isn't the likely answer because this is the X-Files and kind of we know that there's ghosts. But like just in terms of all the stuff they tell them.
Yeah.
It's just, sorry. I want to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really great point and a great question. I was wondering that myself, actually. I hadn't really thought about it until today because, I mean, they're throwing a lot of sort of psychobabble kind of stuff at both Mulder and Scully. But the stuff they come up with is kind of like quite close to the mark. Not necessarily in terms of objective truth, perhaps. That's debatable. But it's certainly in terms of things that will affect them in terms of what do they think of themselves and what will sort of pick away at their insecurities
and their fears.
Thing.
Yeah. Like and you said, fears. Not objective truth, but perhaps when you hit so close to the mark, it makes you uncomfortable. I mean, especially in that scene with Mulder and Maurice, you can see in his face that he doesn't believe him at first. He's like, who's this guy? He's crazy. And then as the scene kind of goes on, he's getting increasingly uncomfortable. You can tell, and just by his body language, that he's pegged him. you know?
Yeah. Yeah, Mulder feels as though he's been pegged, at least.
Right.
Whether he has really for sure, but it certainly makes Mulder feel like he's been pegged.
Or that and it's so possible. Back, yeah.
Yeah, that this it's all the worst aspects of him, of course. It's like the worst version of Mulder and his biggest sort of like insecurities and fear about how he is perceived and the kind of person he is.
Yeah.
But sort of going back to your original question, where do they get that from? I kind of like the theory that because they've been doing these hauntings for so long, they've just gotten really good at reading people.
Yeah.
I mean, this is almost like a little too good. I mean, supernaturally good. Maybe there's got to be some element of the supernatural. But I kind of like the idea that they're just like they are just students of human nature because this is what they've been doing for, you know, the last several decades or century or however long they've been dead for. And so they've just sort of learned what makes people tick because that's all they do all day long is try to figure out how to drive people crazy and to make them do things that they normally never would do. And so they've just taken it upon them as a hobby to sort of learn how people tick. And I think that's kind of cool that they've just kind of assessed Mulder and Scully and just nailed them effectively.
Right. I like that. I really like that theory. And that's probably the truth mostly, but I'm also wondering too if this is kind of like a I want to say like almost like a Zodiac situation or like a psychic thing where you just guess and you're right most of the time because you're saying very vague things in a way, and it's not like he's saying vague things. I mean, the things that he's saying are very specific, especially when it comes down to when he's like, and you probably believe in aliens, like it's stuff like that like it's very actually specific, but it's like he knows it without even talking to him. Like he hasn't even and it's true, maybe they've been observing them because we don't actually run into like Lyta and Maurice until like 20 minutes into the episode interacting with them, so it's possible they've been observing them. And from like the first 10 minutes, I mean, you learn all you need to know about Scully in like the first 3 minutes of the episode.
Yeah.
Really. I guess you could look at it that way, that they've kind of been observing. Okay, all right, we watched them for 20 minutes, we know all we need to know, sit down, go. Let's throw all this shit at the wall and see what sticks, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And they're just very good at reading what's hitting home and what isn't, so,
right?
Yeah,
like any therapist would, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They'd make really excellent therapists, I think, because they seem really good at picking up on people's feelings and concerns, but they'd probably really screw you up if you went to them for therapy.
Right. And, you know, take out the murder and then, you know, also take out
the murder.
What do you call bedside manner when it's a therapy?
Yeah.
It's not.
Could it be couchside manner?
Couchside manner.
Couchside manner. That sounds creepy. But.
Because he's, I mean, Lyta's okay, but like Maurice is a total dick to Mulder. You could tell he's like, okay, I think we're done here. Like,
I kind of feel like Mulder would do well with a therapist like that, though. I think he needs a dick in his life.
Yeah.
Who's going to really like lay it on the line to him, because then it's like, you know, subtlety won't get through to Mulder because he's so sure about himself.
Right.
I think that he could have benefited from Maurice. I mean, honestly, I feel like at the end of the episode, by the time we get to the end of the episode, we'll talk in much more detail about all of this. I felt like Mulder and Scully gained a bit of self-awareness by the end. And I made a note to myself, if this is what they get after encountering Maurice and Lyta for just, you know, an hour or two, imagine what sort of strides they could make in their relationship if they went to real counseling. Because they're clearly, you know, quite adept at sort of taking on board criticism and insight about themselves and each other. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like they're just like thirsting for that, because they react quite well to it by the end and really kind of try to take it on board. These two are like, they are so ready for counseling. Imagine what could have happened if we could have just got them in front of a proper counselor at that point. They were ready.
Yeah, I think you're completely, absolutely right. And that's a very good point that I didn't really think about, but you're right. Like, especially at the end, they both have moments where they're like, huh, like it is definitely a moment of self-awareness. I wanted to bring out too, since we're talking about like therapy and everything, did you think it was kind of interesting and funny that Maurice hit so close to the mark with Mulder talking about all of his issues that send him into, what does he say, fertile fields for the descent into total wacko breakdown, which is what happens?
Yeah,
right.
I mean, Maurice has it nailed on the head. And not only is he accurate, he's very prophetic at the same time.
Yes. I mean, he
nails it. I mean, the paramasturbatory, I'm not too sure even what that word means. But aside from that, all the terms that he's using are not far off the mark. You know, he's talking about obsessive compulsiveness, workaholism, antisocialism. I mean, he's describing Mulder in I Want to Believe frankly.
Yep. Yep.
Obviously, Chris Carter has a good handle on Mulder as a character, mm-hmm. and he can see these qualities in Mulder, obviously, at this stage. And most of the time at this point in the series, we all just kind of say, yeah, he's like that, but he's got lots of good qualities too, and it's fine.
Right.
But by the time we get to I Want to Believe in season 10, those problems become harder and harder to ignore. But they were there all along, for sure. And obviously it makes Mulder very uncomfortable.
It does. And I think it also has to do with like how the circumstances happen to be, like where he is in his life, what situation he is. Like, he, you know, after the truth and between the truth and I Want to Believe, there's a lot of nothing for him.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, what is the phrase about idleness is the devil's plaything? I don't know. What's the, you know what phrase I'm thinking of, right?
Idle hands
are the devil's, something like that.
That's when I need him. He would know that one.
Something about idle hands. Anyway, I should have looked it up. But it was one of those things where it's like he can't deal. Like he needs a therapist. Like he needs somebody to tell him like what do you do with all of this energy when you don't have anything to focus it on. And I mean, so it's just another thing that, again, I am not saying that Chris Carter was like, oh, down the road we're gonna have Mulder have a mental breakdown, you know. But it's here, like we've always said all along, all of the signs are there, and even Mulder knows it. It's like it's just very interesting to see that here in the middle of a somewhat lighthearted season 6 episode, you know?
Yeah, no, it is a really interesting combination, this episode, because it is, you know, there's a lot of really great humor in it. But then there's, you know, this really kind of like sticking the knife in terms of the psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
As well as, you know, genuinely scary stuff as well, and suspenseful stuff.
Right.
So it's a really interesting combination, but really, really, it works well. It's one of these things that it sounds like it would be hard to pull off, but it works really well. And these insights are all like great fodder, because like you said earlier, you know, we don't get a chance to just talk about Mulder and Scully's character like this.
Right.
Especially in terms of like an observer, a very astute observer who's kind of, you know, calling a spade, mm-hmm. in terms of Mulder. And even in terms of Scully, you know, Lyda, doesn't have quite as much to say to Scully as Maurice does to Mulder. But, you know, this idea of intimacy through codependency and that sort of thing, it's like, okay, that's kind of like, that sounds pretty accurate. And again, it's the kind of thing that plays out over the course of their relationship. We see a lot of that.
Do you want to, you know, maybe think of too, and this was also funny because this is another season 6 episode, her reaction to that, again, someone mm-hmm. pegging her is initial, it's very Scully. It's disbelief. She's like, what? Like, but by the end of the episode, she's thinking about it. And it reminded me of the moment in Ranking when Sheila tells her, well, you're just trying to divert me to Holman because you have feelings for Mulder. And she goes, what? And it's like the same reaction, even though we know the truth, that she's still in this place where she's trying to deny it. You know what I mean? And even though we all know that it's true. So it's just very funny. And it's a very Scully reaction, like to have this really abrupt disbelief. And I just wanted to point that out, like their reactions are different, and Mulder's more of like, what else do you have to say, really? Okay. You know, it's just
Mulder's like somewhere between like, you know, interested and then awkward and then a little bit mad because this is just getting too much,
right?
But at no point do I feel as though he's rejecting the sort of assessment that he's getting,
right? And whereas, it's an evolution with him,
whereas
with Scully it's just like how do I get out of here.
But it does kind of sink in on a certain level, because you know, she remembers some of it by the end. So obviously, It's the kind of thing, I mean, I've certainly done that many a time in my life where I'm like, no. And then I think about it later and I'm like, wait a second. I kind of maybe dismissed that a little too quickly. Mm-hmm. So it was, classic Scully kind of reaction, but very much in character for both of them for how they reacted to the ghost psychoanalysis.
The truth has a funny way of coming to light.
That and it does.
On the show and in life.
Definitely.
But that's a really good point that, yeah, we tend to sort of reject the things that we don't want to believe. And then they'll seep their way into our subconscious. Yeah. And I think
they just linger.
Yeah, that's definitely what happened to both of them. And I think, too, there's that shot at the end and where Mulder's kind of on the couch and you can tell he's thinking really hard. Like you can tell he's very thoughtful and we don't really get to see a moment like that with Scully, but we know that he's in his head deep in that moment, like wondering, well, first of all, probably wondering, was any of that real? And second of all, going, what about all that stuff that they said? Like, you know,
yeah, it's definitely, you can just see him thinking. So we get a chance to see him thinking. But then, of course, when Scully shows up at his door, we know she must have been thinking too.
Yeah.
To have been sufficiently motivated to show up at his door at what must be an ungodly hour at that point.
Yeah.
So,
it really must be.
Obviously, this has affected both of them to the point that they're sufficiently uncomfortable that they want to sort of talk about it as soon as possible.
Exactly.
Which is nice.
Yeah. I mean, and again, it's the intimacy through codependency. Who's the one who goes to whose apartment? That's important, right?
Yeah. Everything's important.
Let's talk about loneliness, which is another big theme. And we've talked about this before in our sort of season 6 discussions. I feel like loneliness is a huge theme of the show, but I feel like they touch on it so much during season 6 because they're sort of in this position now. I mean, we've just come off the Fight the Future near kiss and we've got Diana Fally and we've got all kinds of other stuff happening during season 6 that is kind of keeping them from yet again. From moving forward in that regard. And I like the idea that they, even later in Milagro, I mean, I'm jumping all over the place, that when they say, when he says, or she says, I'm not so lonely, and then she says, loneliness is a choice, you know, it's almost, this is all kind of, feels like it's all somewhat connected to what she would have heard in here and what she would have absorbed about the idea of being so afraid of being lonely that you have to, that you would have to do something like this, kill somebody and die with somebody. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not that they ever considered it, but, you know, they believed it for a moment there, you know? So
Yeah. No, it's a very interesting theme. And especially with regards to Mulder, the issue of loneliness comes up a lot. But there's certainly, you know, we can certainly see Scully in that same picture as well, because it is a theme throughout the season. And I find it so interesting that Chris Carter chose a Christmas episode to explore the theme of loneliness, which on the surface seems like kind of an odd choice, but makes perfect sense, really, when you kind of, if we are to look at sort of the festive season without rose-colored glasses on, it can be a very difficult time for people.
Yeah.
And it can be a very lonely time of year. So it kind of makes total sense. We don't see that kind of thing addressed in sort of mass media when it comes to Christmas. Usually every Christmas episode of every show is about how awesome Christmas is. And here's an episode that's not about how awesome Christmas is.
Yeah, it's about how shitty Christmas can be when you don't have all the things that everyone else has. Like, and I mean, I think in the end, by the end, that we realize that they do have that, which I feel like is a little bit of the point of the episode. But I don't quote me on this because I don't know the actual stats, but I do feel like I've heard enough times that it could practically be a cliche that like Christmas is the highest rate of suicide. Like,
yeah, there's something like that. I mean, I know that it's certainly a challenging time of year for everyone, and especially people who have suffered bereavement, especially for people who have mental health challenges. It can be a very difficult time. It's a hard time of year for me. I mean, I've got anxiety, and Christmas is always like, I'm through the roof for the entire month of December, because they're just, you know, there's always these expectations and stress, and it brings back, you know, issues maybe from your past, who knows? So it's just, it can be, that's one of the reasons why I like this episode, I think, is because Christmas can be, I find, a challenging time of year for me. mental health wise. And so I don't see that portrayed very often on television. So I relate a lot to sort of this idea that this idea of Christmas melancholy being a thing, but that, you know, even if your Christmas and your life and your family doesn't look like necessarily the traditional Christmas or the traditional family, it can still be something positive in your life that can fight the loneliness. And in Mulder and Scully's case, it's each other. And that's all they really need. And so there is a positive message in the end. And so I like that in the sense that, you know, it doesn't pretend that Christmas is like perfect and that Christmas fixes everything. But at the same time, there's a message of hope at the end that it is still about connection, but it doesn't necessarily have to be about holding hands around the Christmas tree. So
right.
I like that. I really like that message.
You know, you're totally right about that. It's funny. It just occurred to me on this very show in season 5, during the Emily arc, Christmas Carol. Mm-hmm. I think that Detective Kresge actually says, yeah, a lot of people check themselves out around Christmas time, because
that's right.
Yeah. And so it's funny because it's like which is ironic, because when I watched that episode, kind of makes me want to check myself out, but joking. But that is funny that it's brought up like the season before on this very and I guess that is another sort of Christmassy episode. But like I said,
I think that's the only other Christmassy episode of the X-Files that I could think of was Christmas Carol and Emily. I mean, Christmas Carol and Emily, I think, in my opinion, are the most depressing episodes of the entire series.
I agree.
So clearly, in X-Files land, Christmas is not necessarily the most wonderful time of the year.
No. And I mean, look, we look at this one and even with all of the, this one has everything, you know, it has some silly stuff, it has some depressing stuff, it has some scary stuff, but it ends, like you said, on a hopeful note. And I mean, you cannot say the same about that. About those other episodes,
you cannot.
The episodes that will not be named.
Like, this is like a Hallmark Christmas special in comparison with Christmas Carol and Emily.
Exactly.
So I for me, How the Ghost Stole Christmas has just the right tone for a Christmas episode, because it's not got, you know, the sort of phony everything is perfect at Christmas, but at the same time there is like a realistic element of hope to it, so that someone that maybe isn't in a great place can watch this and say, okay, maybe my life's not perfect, because Mulder and Scully's life aren't perfect. They're not perfect people, but they can still find hope.
Yeah.
And so I think that's I really like that. I like that vibe. It's one of the reasons why I like this episode, I think.
Yeah, totally. Did you see any sort of parallels? I mean, I know that we get the line that we all enjoy where Mulder says, "We're not lovers," which nobody wants to hear. But did you see any other parallels?
So sad, though, when he says
it. I know.
It.
He is kind of sad. He does seem kind of disappointed. He does, right?
He does. Yeah. Like, really disappointed.
It's like, and he gets a little, it's another moment where he gets a little uncomfortable. But parallels between the couples. What is there anything that stood out to you?
I don't know. I mean, certainly I see a parallel in the opening when Mulder's telling the story of Maurice and Lyda in the car to Scully before they go into the house, which is a great story. It's written in the dialogue is very Chris Carter monologue-y style, which normally, you know, I hate, because it's usually very sort of flowery purple prose over the top, but it works perfectly for the story that Mulder is telling.
He's charming her. Yeah.
He's charming her with this sort of, you know, slightly over the top romanticized melodramatic story. And he does tell it. I mean, Scully says right to him, you know, and you told, you know, it's a story that you tell, that you told it well. Mm-hmm. And he does tell it well. It's very sexily delivered. I mean, I was watching it again today, the episode, and I was just sort of closing my eyes and listening during the part when Mulder's telling the story. And I was thinking, I can imagine a lot of other TV shows feeling the need to put some kind of graphics in while Mulder's telling the story. Like, hey, here's some scenes from World War One to sort of show what he's talking about, kind of thing. Just something visual.
Yeah.
But with the X-Files, we are just watching Mulder tell the story, because David Duchovny does an amazing job of telling that story, actually. And it is really well written, actually, and works really well in that context. And so one of the things that he says while he's telling his enchanting story, he talks about Maurice and Lyda, and about Maurice describes him as a brooding but heroic young man, beloved of Lyda, a sublime beauty with a light that seemed to follow her wherever she went. They were likened to two angels descended from heaven whom the gods could not protect from the horrors being visited upon this cold, gray earth. And every time I hear that, I think he's talking about Mulder and Scully.
Yeah,
he definitely
yeah.
is. I don't know if he's deliberately trying to say that. I kind of feel like maybe he's hitting on Scully slightly. I'm not sure.
I think he's unaware. I think they're both.
I think it's entirely possible he's unaware.
Yeah. I just love the idea. I can just picture Mulder like in his car waiting for Scully like for an hour, just like practicing the story over and over. You know what I mean? Like, all right. I got
it. It sounds very well rehearsed.
I love too how he repeats it was a time of dark despair. Like he's really trying to hit it home. She's like, you said that. But there's a great moment where she's enjoying it. She's just smiling and he stops like he's waiting and she's like, go on. Like, you know, she's like, all right, you've got me. Yeah. It was very cute. And
And I love that. I must say, I do love that line, you know, two angels descended from heaven whom the gods could not protect from the horrors being visited upon this cold gray earth. Honestly, I feel like that is a pretty good description of Mulder and Scully.
Yeah.
Because they so many horrors are visited upon them over the course of the series, and the gods could not protect them. And they were like two angels descended from heaven. So mm-hmm. I really love that bit.
In terms of
young Maurice and young Lyda seem a lot like Mulder and Scully. I don't know if ghost Maurice and Lyda are that much like them. But I think anytime you've got an episode that has two couples in it, we are meant to draw parallels of some kind.
They're a little bit more cynical, I think, in their older age, even more so than Scully. So it's a... Yeah, I didn't see a lot of those parallels, but I did enjoy the idea that they know them so well, because it's like, you know, you see a little bit of yourselves probably in everybody. You look for the things that you see in yourself. And I mean, and Maurice even says himself, he's like you said, we've been doing this for years, you know, like everyone that comes here is coming here for a reason. They're obviously here for a reason. You know, why'd you come here? And it's true. Why else would you do that? You know what I mean? Like, why else would you come there on Christmas Eve? It's because you're lonely. Like,
well, exactly. And I mean, Maurice and Lyda, a big part of their whole modus operandi is to convince Mulder and Scully that they are like Maurice and Lyda. And so that they are
that they'll kill themselves. Yeah.
So I definitely can see that as part of, you know, the trap that they lay for Mulder and Scully.
Right. Well, let's talk about that, because it seems like they, you know, obviously their goal is to get them to kill each other, murder, suicide somehow. I do love the part when Mulder is like, she's not going to shoot me. Well, maybe she'll shoot herself. I wouldn't let her. Like, it was just,
I love that bit.
It's very sweet. And I don't even know if like he realizes how sweet that is. Like, because it's
he's just like, it's so sort of quiet, but so sort of rock solid determined. I love that line, actually.
It's really nice, and he says it so automatically. It's just it's almost silly. Like, of course that's not gonna happen. And it does make you wonder, like, they obviously didn't go there to kill themselves. And then you think about, okay, all the other people that went, I guess somebody dies every year or whatever the story is. I don't know how real it is or if it's just a story. Which is actually an interesting point, because if people did die in the house, they did, right? Like,
I think that at one point Lyda maybe says, is it Lyda? No, Mulder at one point says that there have been something like four double murders or murder suicides over the period of time. Since,
okay, so it's not every year.
So it's not every year, but they try it every year, I think.
Right. Well,
not always successful.
And they did say that no one even showed up last year, didn't they say
that?
That's
true.
So So it's possible that, like, you know, business has slowed. You know, they don't want to get take off the tourist literature. Yeah. But it makes me wonder though that the other four couples or whatever that showed up, did they show up for that purpose?
Well, yes, that does raise interesting questions. What's the difference between them and Mulder and Scully?
Right.
Did they show up with that intention, which maybe they did, or maybe their relationship wasn't quite as strong in terms of the trust and faith they have in each other.
Right.
As Mulder and Scully did. Because, I mean, Mulder and Scully, when it came down to it, they did not believe that the other would shoot them.
Right.
Even when presented with lots of evidence that they would. I mean, right up until the moment that they are shot, quote unquote, they think it's not going to happen. You know, Scully says to Mulder, "No, I don't believe a word you're saying." She's does not believe he's going to shoot her. And it's only when, you know, they create the illusion of having been shot that they start to think, wait, I think I've actually been shot. You actually shot me. But up until that moment, they don't believe, there's no way that they believe that that would happen.
Well, and the interesting thing, too, is when you think about it, the fact that they are able to break free from that is is remarkable, especially like considering it even just from Scully's perspective. She sees it all. She sees it happen. She sees Mulder approaching her. She sees him shooting her. She feels herself being shot, right? Like, she feels the blood, sees the blood. There's like, there could not be any more evidence. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And yet, it's all 100%.
Yeah. And yet, based 100% on him saying your favorite line, get up, you're not shot, suddenly they're both snapped out of it. It's
like that.
Yeah. I mean, it is.
It is based on the kind of trust and faith they have in each other, I think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That at the end of the day, they don't believe that either of them would do this, despite all evidence to the contrary.
Exactly. Exactly.
And it's interesting that Mulder's the one who kind of snaps out of it first, because he, I think, is less likely to just to sort of take things as they appear, that he's more likely to sort of look for alternative explanations. And he quite quickly figures it out. I think, you know, Scully
says
something.
I think that's probably why, right?
Yes. Scully says something like, no, you shot me. And he's like, no, I didn't. Okay. I know exactly what's going on here. Took him no time at all to figure it out. And it's one of my favorite lines when Mulder says, get up, you're not shot. It's like my personal mantra when I need to snap myself out of anxiety, which I've talked about before. And the reason why it's so powerful to me is this idea that you can believe something, and this is the root of certainly of anxiety and a lot of mental illnesses. When you have the illness, things seem 100% true to you that are not in fact true, mm-hmm. but it's nearly impossible to convince yourself otherwise. But all it takes is to convince yourself of that for just 1 second. If you can snap out of that, you can overcome amazing things. It can feel like you've been shot and that you're dragging yourself across the floor in a pool of your own blood. And even that you can overcome by just remembering, hey, get up, you're not shot. Just tell yourself that. If you believe that, if you can believe that this is not real, then you can overcome things that seem like they cannot be overcome and things that seem like they are real. And the way Mulder does that is just amazing to me, that he's just like, oh, you know, I haven't been shot. He just stands right up. He goes from seeming as though he's going to die, and he can just stand right up just like that. And Scully can do the same thing. He has to convince her, get up, you're not shot. She's like, yeah, I have been actually.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just takes a couple of seconds, get up, you're not shot. And she's like, holy crap, I'm not. And she just stands right up.
And she believes him.
She believes him. Mm-hmm. She has faith in him. And it can feel like you're dying 1 minute. And if you can just have faith that in the idea you're not shot, that can completely change your perception, change your behavior, change your perception of reality. And so I love that part of the episode, because the episode is a lot about fear, a lot about being afraid. They talk about a lot about, are you scared? I'm not afraid. Yes, I'm afraid. It's not a rational fear. There's that kind of dialogue. And so it's very powerfully done, I think, and it's really interestingly done. And so I love that part of the episode. It's just, I love the fact that, I mean, the first time I watched it, obviously, was at Christmas time, because that's when it aired. And I just remember, because Christmas is my anxiety season, I so needed that message. Could it get up, you're not shot, because I thought I had some kind of weird disease or something at the time. And I was like, ah, no, there's something wrong with me. And I just told myself, get up, you're not shot. And it's amazing. It was like, you know, a life preserver for me. So it's something I need to hear every Christmas. So Yeah. This was a good time for me to watch this episode again, because I always need that message. It's a great message. And it really says so many interesting things about the faith and trust between Mulder and Scully, which I love about their relationship as well. So it's very cool. It's very, very well done. I love it.
Yeah, that's actually that's a really powerful message. And it's interesting too, that like you said earlier, most people want to pull out the happy Christmas movies and that cheers them up. And it's funny that this is what works for you. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's great.
The happy Christmas movies are like fingernails on a chalkboard to me. But
why does that not surprise me, Jen?
Right? I know. This one speaks to me. So it meets me where I'm at. You know, yeah. I'm not necessarily happy at Christmas. So it meets me where I'm at and it takes me to a hopeful place, which is perfect for me.
Well, let's break this down here because I just want to make sure that you're on the same page as me in terms of what exactly happened. So
I mean,
I know there's going to be some guesswork happening here, but I assume that the Mulder that walks in and he's being all over the top dramatic, like more loneliness than 364 shopping days, loneliness.
I think Light overplayed that.
Yes. Yes. And it's funny because the first time you're watching it, I think my husband was like totally buying it and he was confused. Yeah. He's like, what's Whitey Shooter? He was just like totally getting it. And I'm like, well, you'll find out what's going on. Yeah. And it actually cuts to a commercial before you really know what's going on in terms of that. Okay. That's just Lyta playing Mulder, play acting Mulder. Yeah. But it does seem like at a certain point she shoots Mulder and then she tries to, or sorry, she shoots Scully and then tries to like shoot herself. And Ed Asner, he stops her.
Yeah.
Because, and I'm wondering why he's like, no, is this kind of like, because, hey, you're cheating. You know, you got to get her to do it. Like, is it, I was wondering what you thought of that moment.
I'm kind of curious about that moment too, because, you know, Lyta's holding the gun to her head and, you know, pretending to be Mulder, but, you know, Maurice intervenes. The only thing I could think of was that there's some kind of a ghost rule that, you know, don't shoot yourself again. You've already got one hole. You'll put a hole in your head and it'll stay there forever. That was the only thing I could think of, is that maybe the ghosts can still be damaged by guns and they don't want to actually shoot themselves. That's all I could think of.
Yeah. It was just weird to me why she did that, unless he was just, I don't know. That part kind of didn't make sense to me much at all. But
I don't know either. I guess, or I suppose there needed to be a plausible explanation for Mulder still being alive later on, because in their scheme, Scully needs to shoot Mulder. And for that to happen, Mulder has to still be alive. And so the Mulder that Scully is can't shoot himself, because if he shoots himself,
then she
and
can't
then
do it.
The
yeah.
Mulder walks in, the jig's going to be up right then and there. So there has to be a way to get fake Mulder out of Scully's sight.
Right.
So that Mulder can come in and finish the scene, I guess.
So I assume, though, that while Scully's down there, you know, drowning in her blood, Mulder is just up, you know, bumbling around in another room looking for a door, right? Like he's elsewhere completely.
He's elsewhere, yeah.
And then he comes then across Scully on the ground, which is Lyta, again, goes up to her. And I love the difference too in David's acting when he sees Scully and you know this is the real Mulder now, and his reaction to that is just like, he's so concerned. It's so cute. I mean, of course he's concerned, he doesn't believe it. He's just like, what? Like, he doesn't know what happened. He thinks maybe she shot herself, probably, because like how else would she be shot? You know, and then
where the gun come from? Yeah.
Yeah. And then you know, Lyta then shoots Mulder.
Yeah. And again, he doesn't really believe, like, the Lyta is like holding up a gun about to shoot him, and he still doesn't believe that this is going to happen. He says something like, what are you doing?
Right.
And so saying, don't shoot me.
Right.
Which you'd think he kind of might say something like
or
that.
Try and take the gun or something.
But because it's Scully to him, he's like, what are you doing pointing that gun at me? He doesn't believe it's going to happen.
Those faces that they make after they're shot are so telling, like, especially Scully's, but just the face of just like, what, that really happened? Wow. Like, it's something I never believed it that actually happened. Yeah.
But it's just, it's then, so then I assume, and I love this. I actually thought it was a really, really funny moment when Mulder falls and you see Lily Tomlin laying on the ground and she's just like, like, she's so happy. Yeah.
They're having so much fun
they
at this
are.
Point. I think this is Lyta and Maurice are having the most fun because they're getting like, this is the outcome they were going for, which is, you know, we're getting to the best part. This is the part they have the most fun with. And so like, oh, everything's just working out perfectly.
So
and they're having, I think Lyta's a bit of a ham. She loves, this whole play acting thing.
So question, technical question. There are actually no real guns being fired at all, I'm assuming.
Well, no, I guess you're right. There can't be.
Nobody got actually shot. So
no one actually... Yeah, because the only shots that are being fired are from Lyta in both cases, actually. Lyta has a pretend ghost gun.
Yes.
And because she's the one that shoots Scully, quote unquote. And she's the one that shoots Mulder, quote unquote. So yeah, in both cases, you're right. Those are not real guns. So no one's actually, there are no real bullets and no one's actually shot.
Right. I was thinking about the technicality of that because they do make a point at a certain time that they show her drop the gun into Mulder's hand. Like, right. Like, doesn't she pulls his gun out of his holster and is she somehow holding it and then drops it? And he catches it, which is a really cool effect, by the way. I really liked that scene.
Actually, I love that bit.
But I wondered, too, if they threw that in just to kind of, like, tell us or prep us for the idea that these ghosts can handle the real guns. Maybe that's just for the audience benefit so that we think that everyone's really shot. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it certainly would plant the idea in our head that...
That they can. They can do that. Yeah.
Lyta might have actually had Mulder's real gun, even though it turned out she didn't. But yeah, it gives us the idea that she might well have. Because as far as the audience is concerned, right up until Mulder stands up,
everybody's shot. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you think there's
the ghosts, but still shot.
There's the part of you that thinks, oh, well, you know, there's no way that they're shot because it's the middle of season six and they don't die. But you know what I mean? Like, we're wondering, how are they going to get out of this? It's very much like Dreamland. Like, you're 10 minutes from the end and you're like, well, how the fuck are they going to get out of this one? Like, that's just great storytelling, too, because you're just like, okay, please explain this. Tell me how they're going to get out of this, you know? So yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that's
they're not pulling any punches. There's blood everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Herself a Merry Little Christmas is playing. It's super creepy, and I mean that's a great scene.
Yeah, it is.
And then we have the real Mulder and the real Scully together, both shot. That's the first time that they actually see each other, having been shot, quote unquote. And it's a question now of what's going to happen. Like, are they going to figure it out? Are they going to shoot each other now? Because there is a bit of an implication, I think, that they still are, they're on their guard against each other and may, in fact, actually shoot each other, which I suppose...
It's like a standoff, almost.
Yeah, I'm guessing it's what Maurice and Lyta wanted to happen, I suppose, because at some point, someone needs to shoot each other with a real gun.
That's true. That's a really good point. Like, that was the moment where they say, we almost had him. That was the moment where it could have happened. So they do need to point their guns at each other at a certain point.
Their guns at each other at one point, and it's pretty convincing. It's pretty tense stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just at the very last second that they. I think that they kind of lose the will to shoot each other anyway.
Well, I think they're tired. Scully seems very tired. And I mean, Mulder's the one who's literally fallen down the stairs. I mean, we don't really know where Scully's come from. She seems to have a little bit of a head start. You can like see her kind of crawling towards the door. So I assume that maybe she was on the ground floor and Mulder sort of was above her or something.
Yeah. Yeah, they're definitely far apart from each other, I guess.
Yeah, but I love this dialogue.
Scully's in rough shape.
Yeah, I love some of this dialogue at the end too that they have, because there's a moment where I think Scully says, I'm not going to make it, or something like that. And he goes, no, you're not without me, you're not. Or he says something like that.
Yeah.
And it's a great line. It's a great little moment I like a lot.
Yeah, what's what do you think he meant by that? I always find that kind of a curious line. Does that mean like you're not dying without me shooting you first? Because that's the moment when he pointed the gun at me, which kind of always confused me a little bit about exactly what he meant there.
I think that there's, again, multi layers of meaning to that. But I just like the idea that it's like, regardless of what happens in this moment, it's the two of them. They're in it together. If they do die together, that's what's happening. You know what I mean? Right. And I don't think in that moment he's saying, I know I'm going to kill you. I don't think that's what he's saying.
Right.
I think he's just saying, look, you're in this with me. Whatever happens is it's happening together. And I think that's kind of the main reason for that.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that interpretation better.
Yeah, I mean, and that's funny because it never occurred to me that that's what he could have meant. And I don't think that, like you said, even though they're pointing the guns at each other, I don't think that's ever really a question that's going to happen. I feel like that's just like a typical reaction, almost as like a cop, as an FBI agent type thing. Like, I don't know what just happened. All I know is that you shot me. And so I'm defending myself, you know, but I don't think it ever actually crosses either of their minds to pull the trigger. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think that that's really ever going to happen. So in a weird way, I feel like Maurice and Lyta's plan was kind of doomed from the start. Like, I don't think it would have happened. But luckily, you know, Mulder gets to, you know, break free of it. So,
yeah, because I mean, Maurice and Lyta, I think their plan was extremely well executed.
Yeah.
We can't fault them on any level, you know. The psychoanalysis, the planting the seeds, everything was done. I mean, and then the whole scenario of who shoots who and people are getting shot, they pulled it off perfectly. Their plan is flawless. The only reason it doesn't succeed is because Mulder and Scully are who they are and because of the relationship they have.
Yeah, I agree with that completely.
It's very heartwarming. It's a super heartwarming, murdery scene. It's very romantic.
It really is. It's weirdly romantic. And then when they kind of get up and they run out and then we see that there is no blood, there's nothing. And
it's a very cool sort of moment, isn't it?
David makes a really kind of cute face like, oh, holy shit, let's get out of here, you know, and like pushes her. Like,
right.
Again, probably touching her back and guiding her away.
Yes, of course. One thing occurred to me today, completely aside, when Scully gets shot, she kind of looks like she's wearing the same outfit that she has on in Milagro when she's like covered with blood at the end. And I'm thinking that's like Scully's super unlucky outfit, that she always seems to be covered in blood when she has that particular blouse, jacket.
You're right.
Combination. It just looks really similar to me. It's evocative.
You're right.
She just always seems to wind up covered in blood when she's wearing that.
To be fair, I feel like that's a pretty common outfit for her to be wearing.
Yeah.
I feel like she was also wearing that in Fight the Future.
Yeah,
so she also got kidnapped and stung by bees and cock-blocked in that outfit.
It's a great outfit. And she might be wearing something similar when she gets shot in Tithonus, too, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And she just seems to – she gets covered in blood a lot, poor lamb. So
poor Scully.
I've noticed that. Yeah.
She went through a lot of shit in this season.
She did. that reminds me also that I love that bit – as a complete aside again, where Mulder and Scully find the bodies under the floor and they're wearing the same clothes. And that's how they find out that it's them. It's funny the way the scene unfolds, because at first Scully's like, she's got my outfit. And what does Mulder say?
He says, oh, how embarrassing.
Which is hilarious.
That's such a Mulder line. I love it.
It's such a Mulder line. And then Scully says, yeah, well, you know what? He's wearing yours. And that's when they're super freaked out at that moment. And I love that moment, actually, because up until that point, it's a fairly lighthearted episode.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, everything just turns around and it gets super scary, spooky, because that's pretty grisly, actually, that scene.
I love
that scene.
That's funny, too, because I always, I not to go too far into this, but I always wonder what the deal was with that, too. Like, was the idea just to freak them out? Like, to those,
I think so.
Because they also, you know, Maurice and Lyta obviously have the ability to project whatever they want, probably in whatever way. I mean, who knows how ghosts work? Like we said, they have all their own little rules. But like, they obviously know what they're wearing. because they see them. So they're able to just sort of like pick the outfits that they happen to be wearing. It almost would have been freakier if it had been like randomly like David's gray shirt or like Scully's like a different outfit. And then they'd be like, wait a minute, that's my shirt, but that's the one I wore yesterday. What the fuck?
That would be extra creepy.
Right? Like, how do they know that? How would they know their clothes? They obviously know them because that's what they're wearing right now. Anyway.
It sort of creates this sense of inevitability.
Yeah.
Like this has already happened on a certain level.
Yeah.
It cannot be resisted.
Right, right. Anyway, I get on a practical level why they did it, but I was just almost thinking that in retrospect, would that be freakier if they actually somehow knew their real clothes? I don't know.
It was cool. I thought it was really cool. And plus, you know, Mulder wearing leather jacket.
Oh, yeah.
My favorite looks. So
he liked that leather jacket a lot in this season.
Yeah, and I love it every time because a lot of the times they're doing cases outside of the FBI, like in this case, because they're not assigned to the X-Files in season 6. And so we get some opportunities for non-FBI clothes,
mm-hmm.
although it's hard to
tell. Not
Scully.
For Scully. I mean, Jesus. Put on some jeans, Scully.
This is what she went when she's Christmas shopping, apparently.
I remember this. Yeah, God, I remember this as one of my huge pet peeves about the show. I feel like Scully's clothes was such a big one on my pet peeve list. I was just annoyed why they never dress her in anything casual, ever. Exactly.
Yeah, because, I mean, Mulder's very casual in this episode. Why can't she be a little more casual? Come on.
I mean, it doesn't even need to, like, affect her character. Like, we've seen her wearing casual clothes at home on occasion. So it's like,
we'll still know it's Scully. It's fine.
Exactly. I don't know. It just drives me nuts when she's wearing like her work clothes, like all the time. Like, come on, give her a freaking sweatpants.
No, exactly. That would have been nice. That would have been a treat.
Yeah.
As
anyway,
they were dressed really similarly because they're both wearing sort of white tops with something black over it.
Right.
So.
Right. Right. Anyway. Random tangent, but I always have to bring that up because
these are the things that trouble me most in the world are the random tangent things.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move into the final scene of cuteness. What do you say?
Oh, God. Yes. Let's. I love the scene of cuteness.
Yeah. I mean, who doesn't? It's so cute. I mean, we know that our codependent Scully has to come to Mulder in the middle of the night. It's cute because it is kind of a backwards thing. Like, usually he's the one calling her in the middle of the night, like waking her up for a random...
Right.
You know, random bullshit. But like for this, he didn't. Like
true. She comes to him, and you could tell probably he would have liked to have called her, but he knows he's already kind of imposed upon her enough.
Yeah, it's like that self awareness you were talking about. It's like on this night, the roles are very, very much in tune with what they've been told. Like they're both sort of, I don't want to say feeding into it or giving into it, but they're both sort of like absorbing that and realizing that, you know, it's true. Part of it is true. And even their behavior and the way they approach each other is borne out through that. I just find that really interesting.
Yeah. No, I think that's very, very cool as well. And very, it's very compelling. I love the bit when Scully shows up at the door. First, Mulder can't believe she's there because he thinks it's his neighbor knocking on his ceiling or something because he looks up.
Oh, no, he thinks it's ghosts. Oh, he thinks it's ghosts.
Ghost, you think? Yeah.
Totally. That was always
out at that point.
Yeah, that was always how I read that. Is that he's like, oh shit, are there ghosts?
Oh, that I was never thought of that.
Yeah, that's funny. That's what I was.
And he's watching A Christmas Carol, I think, mm-hmm. which of course is a Christmas story with ghosts in it, which is cool.
Yeah.
So I love it when Scully shows up and she just doesn't quite know how to articulate exactly what she's there for, and eventually just says, "Can I come in?" And it's just kind of like it's just a very sweet little moment between them, and.
Yeah.
Scully doesn't ask for that kind of thing very often. So it was just kind of very sweet.
Yeah.
I just love it. I love the whole vibe between them. And, you know, they're being a little more self-aware. And that moment when, you know, Scully says, you know, maybe I did want to be out there with you. And it's just very sweet. It's just one of those wonderful Scully Mulder look moments. They just share a lovely look.
It's rare sort of naked honesty. We don't see that very often with the two of them, that they actually talk about how they're feeling and they're honest about it.
And they're trying to do the right thing and trying to say the right thing.
Yeah, and they're even kind of like, she says, she's asking him, is that really what happened? Like, was that all just in our heads? It's like, she's not coming at him like she normally would, saying, oh, Mulder, you're full of shit. You know, she's not doing that. You know,
That's right.
They're reacting to each other a little bit differently. Like he he's smarmy like Mulder, and he's like, well, what, you didn't want to be out there? And then he kind of goes, oh, wait, that's narcissistic of me. Like, yeah. He's catching himself. She probably has no idea what he's talking about. But likewise, yeah. It's like she does the same thing, whereas typically she might just kind of roll her eyes. She tells him the truth. You know, she says, you know, maybe I just did want to be out there. It goes back to the beginning with her coming out of the car and being like, I'm not going to do it. It's my New Year's resolution. Not going to do it. Which is another very funny moment. But like, it makes me wonder, like, what actually compels her? Mm-hmm. I mean, as always, as every week, to follow him. And it goes just to that question, is maybe it's as simple as you just wanted to be there. And I love that about it. I wanted to bring up to you because we went past it. And the moment in the Christmas Carol that they were showing was the moment at the end where Scrooge, you know, figures out the true meaning of Christmas. Yeah.
And he's so happy.
Yeah, he says, I think the line is actually, I don't deserve to be this happy.
And that's when they cut to Mulder, I think.
That's when they cut to Mulder. And I think that's just, it's very, very pointed, you know, and obviously very intentional. And it's just one of those things that I'm constantly, it's a constant push-pull with Mulder and Scully, how rarely they're allowed these moments of levity or happiness. It's almost like the show people don't think they deserve to be happy, you know? and I know a lot of people think that. I know that's not the case because, again, this is what the show is about. But it's just one
that's
of those...
television.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that kind of... You cut to that shot of Mulder and he's just thinking so hard and you're like, no, you guys, you do deserve to be happy. Have your little moment. And they get to, you know what I mean? It's very sweet.
Yeah. Because I think Mulder it is quite likely that Mulder doesn't believe he deserves to be happy. I think that could easily be part of his psyche because of a lot of shit that he's been through.
Absolutely.
Then to kind of, you know, he's proven wrong just a few minutes later when Scully shows up and... Happy, happy Christmas gift exchange.
Yeah, it's so cute.
And they are truly happy.
They are. They're very happy. We get to see that rare little Scully smile that we don't really ever get to see. And I kind of forgot that we got to see that in this episode. I really did because it is rare. I mean, we get to see her smile occasionally, but that particular smile is very rare. And it is one of those moments where they both are genuinely happy. And I love the idea. Yeah. I love the idea that we don't see what is in the presents. It's definitely one of those things that it always baffles me because the same people that probably love the ending of this and how we kind of pan out and give them their moment are the same people that hate the church whisper.
Yeah.
And it's the same exact thing. It's, you know what? This is not just this is another X-File, but this is them having their moment. And you know what? We don't get to see it. We're not going to get to see it because it's for them. And I think that's kind of cute and I like it. Especially here. I thought about that a lot when, you know, during Nothing Lasts Forever and we did the whisper. And I mean, it's never, ever going to stop being a question. Just like these Christmas gifts. It's like it's never going to stop being... talked about what were in those in those Christmas presents. Yeah. And I mean, that's brilliant. It's beautiful.
That's exactly what they're trying to create. I mean, you know, Frank Spotnitz, our new friend, mentioned that when we were talking to him that, you know, they love the idea that people are still talking about this stuff years later. That's exactly what they wanted to create. And boy, howdy, did they.
They lead it to a question is what he said. It's like you use all these different methods not to necessarily get an explanation or an answer, but to lead to another question. And they do. It's so good.
It's very cool. And it's always, you know, we get just enough answers so that we're not constantly frustrated.
Right.
You know, it's frustrating in kind of a fun way, but not frustrating in kind of a, I just give up and I'm out. Because I've done that with TV shows where it's kind of like, you're giving me nothing. I'm completely confused.
Yeah.
I don't know where this is going. I don't understand any of this. You're not giving me any answers. And it's like, sorry, no, you're done. But, you know, the X-Files just kept me coming back. They just always managed to have that balance of just giving me enough to keep me going. And they do a brilliant job. And this is a great example of it. You know, this isn't about an alien. It's about a Christmas present. But it's the same principle, which is show just enough. And the way they sort of pull back through the window of Mulder's apartment is very much like, you know, we're leaving them now, which I think is kind of a little similar to the end of Existence at the end of season 8.
Yeah.
The very last shot with Mulder and Scully together. The camera sort of pans out through the bedroom door, essentially, to kind of like, we're leaving them now. So it's kind of a similar kind of vibe, which is kind of nice because, like, they deserve that. They deserve to have happiness and peace.
Well, I mean, it absolutely. And on the flip side of that, you can take an episode like Never Again, and it ends the same way, but just in a different vibe, with a different tone. You know, we're panning away from the two of them sitting with that desk between them, and we're leaving them. And we're leaving them now. We don't know how that resolves. We don't know how that happens. And I feel like that is just the name of the game here. And this is just one of those particularly very well illustrated moments. So I got to ask you, Jen. Do you have any theories about what's in those presents?
About the gifts?
Yeah.
I mean, they've made them quite interesting shapes, haven't they? They didn't just go with standard boxes.
Well, I think it's pretty clear Mulder has a video.
I think a video is a very good guess.
From the way he shakes it, too, in the size.
It kind of seems like a video to me. I mean, if I had to guess, it's something kind of jokey, probably, like something paranormal. I mean, you can get so many crazy paranormal videos, especially in the 90s. So it could be something like that. I want to imagine it's something like, you know, sex secrets of the Sasquatch or something like that. Just something really like something that somehow that sort of plays into his love of porn and his love of the paranormal.
I agree with you together completely, because that was in my head canon was that she got him some sort of like alien anal probe porno video. Yeah.
Exactly.
Just as a joke, because I just think that I could totally see that actually happening. Because they've been so comfortable joking about the porn for six years that I just think that would be hilarious.
I think that's exactly probably what it is. Now, of course, Scully's is an interesting shape.
Yeah.
It's cylindrical. And I'm going to pick something less commonly suggested. And I'm going to say it's like some kind of goofy kid's toy of some kind, like a kaleidoscope or something.
Yeah, I feel
something with a hint of whimsy.
Yeah, I feel like I read that in like a fic or something, that it was that a kaleidoscope is very cute and very sweet.
Yeah.
I've read a bunch of different things. I mean, we got to give Jillian a shout out. One of the panels, it was so brilliant. They were talking about that. They asked them, David and Jillian, what they thought was in the presents.
Yeah.
And she goes, what season was that?
Jeez.
And they were like, six. And she's like, well, I know what I needed. And they were laughing, and I think David was like, well, it was cylindrical shape, and she goes, oh, well, there you go.
Exactly.
It was so funny.
Well established.
It makes me wonder, like, they don't plan that shit. I mean, these are audience questions, right? It was it was so funny. It was just such a very well played moment. I always remember it.
So what's your guess for Scully?
Well, I just told you. No,
that's it.
I honestly don't know.
You subscribe to that theory.
I actually don't think I really subscribe to that theory, because I just think I think with everything going on in season six, I think there's a lot. There's too much tension.
Yeah, it's just a bit too much.
Yeah, too much underlying tension for that to be the gift.
Yeah.
I think that he might have given that to her even like in season five probably in season seven. I feel like that would have happened even.
Yeah.
But I don't think in season six. I don't know. I think it's funny.
A little too close to the bone, maybe. No pun intended.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, actually, once I kind of chucked that idea, I went back to the drawing board, and I really don't know. But I like the idea of like a kaleidoscope or something like that. I think that's
kind of something kind of fun.
Yeah.
Something for Scully to
lighten up.
to have a little bit of fun in her life. Something kind of fun and whimsical. So that's as much as I've been able to figure out. I no doubt Chris Carter has no clue what those gifts were necessarily supposed to be, but he was like, just put them in weird, interesting shapes so that it'll give the fans something to talk about.
Well, here's the thing. I'm 100% convinced that that's an actual videotape. So I'm curious what, even though it's not the videotape, I'm curious what videotape they wrapped. Like, you know what I mean? Because it had to be something.
Yeah. Do they just have like
a blank one or something?
Blank videotapes around? Yeah. I mean, my house had like blank videotapes on every horizontal surface. So
right.
I don't know if TV studios are like that.
They are. I mean, around that time, they probably are. I'm sure they were able to find something, which is really cute. I mean, that some poor PA, they're like, oh, shit, we got to get those gifts wrapped. Go find a video. Wrap that right now. But I wonder, too, about like Scully's could literally be like a paper towel roll.
I know.
Yeah,
that's
right?
What I'm thinking it is. That's what it looks like.
Yeah, I was like, well, something was wrapped.
I feel like whatever the gifts were, they were freaking adorable.
Yeah, I love it.
Well, before we head out, do you have anything else that we didn't get to talk about? Any highlights or scenes that stood out for you?
No, I think we talked about all of them, which was great because, I mean, I love all of the scenes of this episode. They work really well together. I've watched it a lot. Like, it's right up there. I mean, it's my number 15 on my top 25 in terms of how much I love it. But in terms of the number of times I've watched it, it probably makes it the top 10 at least. Because it's just the kind of episode I can just watch over and over again. And there's nothing about it that I don't like, really. So I'm glad we had a chance to break it down and talk about all my favorite things about it.
Yeah, I think we talked about pretty much everything. The only thing I wanted to mention that was just so random and would never, ever come up in any other episode ever was the part where Mulder is like up on the landing and Lyta's there and he's like kind of looking for an exit and he kind of picks her up and like moves her aside and she goes, "Masher." And I think that's like so funny and random. And it's also another one of those throwaway lines I don't like we talked about like last week or the last episode when Sheila's yelling, "Not his face, don't punch him in the face." It's one of those things that you might not catch every time, but like every time I see it, I look for it because I just find the way she delivers that line so funny. She's like, "Masher."
She's just so good.
She's delightful.
Every line she delivers is gold for me.
Yeah. I mean, is that all you really had to say, or do you have anything?
That's it. I love How the Ghost Stole Christmas, and everyone should definitely watch it at Christmas time because there's a lot of very valuable stuff you can take from it at any time of year. I rarely watch it at Christmas. This is probably the first time I've actually watched it at Christmas since it originally aired, just because I watch it, you know, randomly throughout the year.
Yeah, same.
So it was kind of fun to watch it at Christmas time. So I highly recommend everyone, when you finish listening, go put it on. It'll make you feel many different things, which the X-Files always does.
It was nice to watch it with like the Christmas tree in the background. Yeah, that was very, very, very unique. Anyway, guys, thank you for listening. And please tweet at us. Let us know what you think of this episode. I know pretty much everyone, I think, loves this episode universally. But we'd like to hear from you guys at XFD Podcast. Tweet at us. Let us know what you think. And, you know, whatever you happen to celebrate. Hope you guys have a happy holiday this year, and we'll be back with you after the new year.
Bye!
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let yourself be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay. From now on, our troubles will be miles away. Here we are, as in olden days, happy golden days of yore. Faithful friends who are dear to us, gather near to us once more. Through the years we all will be together, if the fates allow. Until then we'll have to muddle through somehow. So have yourself a merry little Christmas now.
Here we are as in olden days, happy golden days of yore.
Faithful friends who are dear to us, gather near to us once more. The years we all will be together, if the fates allow. Hang a shining star upon the highest bough, and have yourself a merry little Christmas.